pandemic got us into a reflective space and made us look inward to see what we can do for the world at large. As a self-expression coach, I became a catalyst for women and started Vani, a one-on-one coaching program for women on finding their voice, to speak up, to be visible. As a storyteller, I spotted there were many ordinary people amongst us leading extraordinary lives, making a difference to the world, and they needed to be heard. Thus was born You and I with Rashmi Shetty, where amazing personal journeys with their uniqueness and individuality are showcased. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. Today's episode is a very special one. Our guest today is Apurva Purohit, an Indian businesswoman with over 3 decades of experience in the corporate world, where she has built and scaled up a diverse set of businesses and overseen their transformation from traditional firms to new age conglomerates. Apurva has recently launched Azol Ventures Private Limited, a social impact company which connects women self-help groups and micro-entrepreneurs, making traditional and local food products with consumers looking to source wholesome and healthy food items. She's also an independent director at Marico Limited, Mindtree Limited, L&T Technology Services Limited, and Naveen Fluorine International Limited. Apurva has been a leading voice in the Indian business landscape, advocating gender diversity, and works with organizations and leaders to improve this critical imperative. She is the author of 2 national best-selling books, Lady, You're Not a Man, The Adventures of a Woman at Work, and Lady, You're the Boss. Over the years, Apurva has won multiple business awards and has been named as one of the most powerful women in business as per the India Today Group and Fortune India over several years. She was amongst LinkedIn's top voices and Your Story's top 10 digital influencers and won the Distinguished Alumni Award from her alma mater, IIM Bangalore, in 2022. Apurva holds a bachelor's degree in physics and has completed her PGDM from IIM Bangalore. She was a state-level hockey player and played for Tamil Nadu State and Tamil Nadu University. Listen in as Apurva shares her inspirational journey, and I love personally her message on empowerment. Hi, Apurva. For me, this is a dream podcast because I have loved you and the work that you do. Every post of yours is so beautifully crafted. The fact that you have gone on a journey that's so inspirational for us women, but you continue to do the same. I'm very curious to know what little Apurva was like to the Apurva Purohit that the world knows you today as. Welcome to You and I with Rashmi Shetty.
Thank you, Rashmi. It's a pleasure to be here. And I've read about what you're doing, and it is inspirational because, you know, it takes time, effort, enthusiasm to 140 podcasts to put it out in the world and share stories of people with a large audience. I think we need you more than you need us.
Thank you. So was little Apurva also as inspirational as the Apurva that the world sees you today as? What was your journey like? Where were you brought up? What were your influences? I'm really curious.
Children who've grown up in the 60s and 70s, our parents are really the first post-partition children in that sense. So my parents were very young when their parents moved over to India, had to leave a lot of wealth and prestige behind and start from scratch all over again. In reflection, when I look back, I definitely see that my parents were, you know, very driven, very hardworking, and they had seen plenty move to zero. So for them, the journey was really to move back to the plentifulness of their childhood, right? So there was a lot of ambition that they had, some of which that they could fulfill, some which couldn't, because our country was a young country and had its own set of challenges. So I think that was really the first defining factor for all of us. And the second bit was, of course, that for them to grow, the only way was education. So a lot of focus on studies, 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 education, education. And of course, we didn't have the kind of, other stimuli and other distractions that exist today. So it was really school and back home, no television even. So in that sense, it was studies and home. I was the eldest of three children and also quite bright and studious and hardworking. So in a sense, my mother channeled all her ambition, all her desires through me. So I don't remember, but from a very young age, she was always, you will go and study in an IIM, because she had heard that her cousin was, one of my cousins had studied in an IIM, a girl then who had worked in, professionally worked in, let's say, I remember, I think it was Citibank at that time, which used to hire a lot of people from the IIMs. So she was, for her, that had become like a bellwether of what I should do because I was good in my studies. So it was always, you'll get into an IIM, you'll work. So in my mind, and I'm glad about this, it was never that I will not have a career.
Oh,
but today, when I look around and I talk to all youngsters and I see that they're so confused because they're getting mixed signals that someone's telling them, okay, you can work, you should work only till you get married. And why do you need to work if you have children? So on and so forth. I didn't have those mixed signals at all. It was very, very clear that I will have a career. So I think that sort of kind of underlined what I did later on in life.
But Apurva, this is very surprising because I'm a 70s girl. So in the 60s, 70s, until maybe mid 80s, there were only three paths, either medicine, engineering, or law. Nobody spoke about IIMs like the way you are so clearly focused on what you want to do. I love the way your mother put that dream in you or expectation in you. And when you look back, didn't any of these typical careers, which people followed by the herd mentality, affect you? It was very clear, it's only IIM. It doesn't matter how I'm going to go there, but I'm going to go to the IIM. That's what was your clarity?
Actually, I just don't remember ever having this conversation about engineering or medicine, etc. My brother did his engineering. Okay. My sister did hotel management.
Okay.
So very diverse careers. My mother was very focused on IIM for some reason. It was not even MBA. It was not management. Okay. It was IIM. And I think that really stemmed from what she saw of that cousin.
Yeah.
And therefore, I didn't even, for example, I remember in 11th, 12th, all of our batchmates trying to get into the IITs and studying hard for engineering colleges, etc., which was, as you very rightly saying, one of the three paths that were available. I remember that I said, oh, I don't need to study for the 12th at all because I know I'm not going to get into engineering. I will just do my graduation because after that, I'm going to give the CAT exam. So it was 3 years later, nothing, a 12th exam was not important.
Okay, this is nice. This is very interesting. And then what happened in your 12th? So since you were good in studies, I'm sure obviously you did well in 12th. And what did you pursue post 12th standard?
The third impact, or the third driver or influencer in our life was really the fact that my father had a transferable job, Rashmi. So he was, you know, like the army, he was in oil. So every 3 years we used to get transferred. So I've stayed in all parts of the country, which again has come to good use later on in life because you understand South India, you understand Northeast, you understand North India and all the specific regional cultures and influences there. So again, after 12th, we got transferred and we moved to Chennai. And that's when, you know, I suddenly from studying in Xavier's went to Stella Maris, which was almost like back to convent school. And
I know where you're coming from.
Suddenly from the freedom of Xavier's, you're going in from a co-ed college, you're going to
all
girls. And there again, you go there and you suddenly realize that I got 90%, but 90% is not good enough.
Yeah.
So you have to get 97% if you want admission in a decent course. So the only place I'd got 97% was physics. So willy-nilly, I got pulled into doing physics as my graduation. Again, I don't regret it at all. As I said, we had very few choices. And for me, it was, okay, graduation is just the route. That CAT exam is the most important exam. Mm-hmm. I think that was, that worked out fine. And those 3 years I very much enjoyed. I enjoyed the fact that we were, you know, in an all-girls college and no unnecessary boyfriend influences, etc. So it's you remain disciplined into your studies. I got a chance to play hockey because Stella really pushed all of us to have, you know, sound of body and sound of mind is very important. And therefore, you have to play a sports. I hadn't played a sports at all in my earlier student life. So I ended up playing hockey, which I again enjoyed very much. So good things happened. And then, of course, after that, after the graduation, I did get into IIM Bangalore.
Okay. So from
my mother's dreams.
I'm now curious, a very inquisitive question. What was your mother's reaction when you got into IIM?
So it was very interesting because it was more than me. It was her heart and soul that was really riding behind me getting into IIM. And, you know, on reflection, you see that at that moment, yeah, you're studying. And I was studying. I actually got through all the written exams, the written test, and got shortlisted in all the IIMs. There were 4 IIMs at that time. So Ahmedabad, Bangalore, Calcutta, Lucknow. And then we had the group discussion and the interview. And I was very sure because I'd done extremely well in the written exam, because you don't get shortlisted for all the 4 unless you're really amongst the top toppers. And then I didn't get selected even in 1.
Oh.
First lists came out and I didn't get selected even in 1. And my mother wept more than me. She cried so much. I was so sorry for her. Then, you know, we were just figuring out, okay, now what? Because we didn't have a plan B.
Yeah.
Was very clear that I would get. And I still remember that day that I was just standing near and the postman came and gave me the orange colored letter and I'd got into IIM Bangalore. The lists were, you know, they send out the first list and the second list. So and then IIM Bangalore. And then I went in and my mother was in the kitchen. I went and gave the letter to her. Again, she burst into tears, this time of joy.
Yeah. It was a dream manifestation.
Yes. For her.
And her dream manifesting through you,
yes,
I think was a moment that I'm sure she'll never forget. No. But on hindsight, Apurva, for you, when you got in there, did you know that, yes, now my career is set and IIM is the place to be in order to have a management career?
Yeah, because I mean, while we, of course, she always kept on saying IIM, the IIM was just a route, right? So you knew that IIM was a gateway to a career. IIM was a gateway to entering corporate India. Because again, remember, my father was a government servant, my mother's a teacher. Mm-hmm. Our influences, the people around us are the same. So we have lived in ONGC colonies all around, moved around there. And from city to city, we've moved in ONGC colonies. So the people we know are people from that same environment.
Yeah.
Right. Then you are seeing the boys all getting into engineering or medicine. Not very many got into law at that time. I don't remember that. But medicine and engineering, they're going. Girls are just waiting to get married. Yeah. So you don't even have anybody to sort of guide or advise or tell you. And you don't have an entry into corporate India. You don't know anybody who's the vice president of a bank. Or that hadn't even opened out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
talking about the mid-80s, right? So that didn't even open up. So you didn't know people in corporate India.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our only way into that kind of a career.
Mm-hmm.
And
as far as corporate India was concerned also, there was not much written about it, like how people today know about it. It was more the public sectors that people were talking about, Doordarshan was focusing on. So mid-80s must have been when things were slowly opening about corporate India. So when I'm sure your days in IIM Bangalore also must have been very memorable. But for a girl who finished graduation in the city of Madras at that time, to come into IIM Bangalore and see the complete change and shift in the whole atmosphere of the campus itself is divine. I'm sure, can you recall what shifted in you when you entered the campus and those years in IIM Bangalore?
So, you know, to be very honest, yes, it was a moment, okay? It was a milestone moment, a very, very important event in my life. Mm-hmm. But we were brought up in very protected environments, right? So you had lived in, you had studied in convents, you had lived in a sheltered society, your parents didn't allow you to go out too much. There were not too many conversations that were happening about even, you know, the larger world. We didn't discuss politics over dinner time or, you know, value systems. You didn't, you just worked hard. That's all.
Yeah.
So, from that shelter to suddenly come out, come into this place where there are suddenly 120 guys and just 9 girls. Mm. I would say that it sort of was a little bit of a negative experience because you are, that's the first place, for example, where I felt a certain kind of bias operating. I mean, girls are different. I hadn't thought of myself as different, right? We had not been brought up like that.
Yeah.
We were brought up very similarly, my brother and I. I don't even remember thinking of gender as a thing. Mm-hmm. But then suddenly get here and then girls are supposed to do this and boys are supposed to do this and boys are smarter and girls are not. And those kind of influences mm-hmm. and biases operating. So I didn't enjoy my first year. Then fortunately, I did my internship in an advertising agency in Chennai.
Okay.
And I had a wonderful boss. And suddenly he opened my eyes out to advertising and marketing and thinking strategy. And I said, my God, I enjoy this strategic thinking so much. I enjoy branding so much. I was determined after that internship that I would get into marketing or advertising. So when I went back, I was a changed person.
Okay.
The second year, I very much enjoyed because now sort of I found my groove. Otherwise, I was a bit lost.
Mm.
I was a bit lost. In the first year.
Yeah, yeah. No, I completely get what you're saying. And when you went back in your second year, you specialized in marketing or? Yeah.
I was specialization as you sort of got your PGDM in general management.
Management.
You could pick and choose your electives, which were in a particular subject. So I obviously picked all the marketing, whatever I could find on marketing and advertising and communication. And I was determined that year two, somehow or the other, I'll get into an advertising agency. And indeed, the same boss gave me a pre-placement offer. So that also gives you confidence.
Yes.
Suddenly you're saying, okay, you're a bit lost. And then you're saying, okay, there's this person who's running an agency and he wants you. He thinks highly of you. So I think my sort of world came together in the second year post the internship.
Okay, so you went back to Chennai to join the ad agency.
Yes, and yes.
Then how did your career progress?
Oh, the first few years I worked in advertising, very much enjoyed it, very much. I got married. I've met my husband at IIM. He was a year senior. So, so while the
But first year you didn't talk to anybody. How did you meet?
Yeah, exactly. Rashmi, aankho aankho mein baat ho gayi.
Achcha. Okay.
So you know the other parts of my life were not going well, but I met Sanjay, and then you know we figured out, and then year two he had gone. Though of course my mother says that you did better in studies in year two because he was not around. I say I have found my groove. So the jury's out that why did I do better in year two than I got married immediately after I passed out, and we came to Bombay, worked in the advertising agency for a few years, very much enjoyed this whole brand creative. We were working with some great clients, Colgate. We launched Palmolive soap for the first time in the country. It was very interesting. I still remember that our first ad was an educational ad where we are trying to explain to people what is oily skin, combination skin, dry skin. Imagine. I mean, look at where the world has gone today. So, actually explaining there are three different types of skin combinations and so on. So, very, very nice time. I had did very well also. And then over a period of time, I started finding this whole media part fascinating. So, Doordarshan and what the new media had just started coming in, the ZTVs, etc. So, the one part of advertising was, of course, the creative part. The other part was the media, the thinking, the strategy, the quant part, which again I took to. And then one of my bosses said that, we want to launch a division. Why don't you head it? And that was a chance to run a P&L for the first time at a very young age. And then I sort of got driven into P&L management, etc.
And Apurva, now when you look back, what was one of the most bold steps that you took? Because clearly, you had a typical upbringing like most girls had in that age group. At that time, in fact, those decades of growth, India was parallelly also changing. And in a situation and environment where girls had very limited dreams of getting married and moving rather than a career, here you were very clear, I am is going to be where you are. And like you said right at the beginning, I'm going to work post that. So it was very clear to you, you're going to have a career. Now, when you see how you started and the way life opened that ad agency for you and opened you to branding, today everyone's talking about visibility, personal branding, why it's important. You did that way back in the 80s. And over the years, I'm sure you've seen how it has evolved. But I'm sure the basic benchmarks are still the same. So, when you look at how the evolution of branding has happened over the years, and since you have helmed it as well, how do you look at the growth and what do you see as the entire trajectory of this phrase today, which is personal brand?
So, as you're very rightly saying, I mean, branding, communication, creative, consumer insight, making a difference, going into the consumer's mind and positioning. You remember one of the big books at that time was a book called Positioning Itself. So, all these things have been there for a long time. And I think I was fortunate enough to be part of advertising in its heydays, where really we were the brand custodians. We worked very closely with our clients to develop and build brands. And we built some marquee brands, as I said, Palmolive or Santoor soap, all those soaps we have built, right? So we are very proud of that part. I think over the years, what happened is suddenly the platforms have started becoming more and more important. So there's communication, there's creativity on the one hand. On the other hand, it's all the platforms that became bigger. So first of all, you had only Doordarshan. Then from Doordarshan, you suddenly had 20 television channels, of which Zee was very prominent. Then from 20 television channels, you had 500 television channels. Then from 500 television channels, suddenly there's also digital and there is also so many magazines and there's also outdoor and there's also activation. So the opportunities to advertise and try and reach the consumer's mind kept on increasing. The way to do it was still the same. And that's really brand building, but the opportunities multiplied, and somewhere that noise started becoming bigger than the message itself. The noise started becoming, and it is indeed so even today. Today, if you advertise on Facebook, it's not about brand building as much as it is, okay, if, let me try and run 10 different ads. The algorithm will decide which ad reaches and which ad makes a difference, which ad is able to convert. So it's become so much of that. However, I still maintain that if you don't concentrate on what the brand is, whether it is a personal brand, what is Rashmi, what is Apurva, what do I stand for? And many years ago, we learned the T plan. Who are we? Where do we want to be? How do we get there? What is the trigger in the consumer's mind, or what is a need we are fulfilling? What is the support I have to fulfill that need? Now, this 5-point T plan, I think, is applicable even today. Unfortunately, brands, the new brands, have got lost in this noise about platforms and algorithms. And for example, Azul, we have worked so hard on the brand. What does this brand mean? The name even, starting from the name to how the visuals should look, to how the packaging should look, to which products. The brand determines which products we will sell or not sell. Whereas for the others, it's the other way around. There's a product and there's a platform. Now let me throw money behind it.
Yeah. Now that you brought Azul, I would love to know what does the name mean? And what was the idea behind it? What triggered you at that point to even think? Because I think Azul started just before the pandemic.
Yeah, indeed.
So how did you even think of that, and what does the name mean?
So Azul, the name means the home of your maternal grandmother.
Oh.
Nani ka ghar.
Okay. Patti ka ghar. In Marathi.
In Marathi, yes.
Okay.
Aji,
okay.
Aji. Nani, Patti, Aji, Aji ka ghar.
Oh, okay.
So the whole idea was that there is such a lot of talent in terms of whether it's handicrafts or apparel or food that exists in our country. And we have lost touch with it because it's all now in rural India, and urbanites have now moved to processed food or international jasmine rice, which you will fly down from Bangkok, little realizing that you have something called Indraini rice, which is as sticky and as aromatic available in a small region of Maharashtra. So there's a disconnect. Yeah. At the same time, nutritionists, on the other hand, are telling us, no, you eat more local, eat more natural, eat more seasonal. Mm. But as consumers, we are not able to find such products any longer. So our idea was to connect the consumer back to their roots, which is why, you know, what you last ate in your nani's house, and therefore the name. And more importantly, it's a social impact mission, Rashmi, because, you know, pandemic hit everybody very hard. It hit the bottom of the pyramid harder.
Yes.
So the women that we encountered during the pandemic, my son did a lot, you know, lot of traveling in Maharashtra, and you realize that they're such lovely women. They're making such great food products, but they're not able to sell it because they don't have supply chains. Mm-hmm. They don't understand market linkages.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you produce the food which you've been producing for generations. We will find the market for you.
Okay. And what prompted your son to get into that space? Was it because of the break? Are you from Maharashtra originally? How did even you choose Maharashtra over other states that you said that you traveled all through the country? What is it about Maharashtra first? And how does your son come into this picture at this point? Because just before pandemic, people were talking about climate change and local food. And the pandemic told us it is real. And local is definitely the need of the hour. So they all fell in place, and the universe had conspired to put it in place. But what were the influences of your son? Were these points of discussion at home as well?
Interestingly, he's been a consultant for the last 7-8 years, and he worked in Kani Consulting after his master's, etc. And he had been talking about, you know, wanting to do something in the social impact space. And more importantly, he had always said that, Mommy, I want to work with you. It's one of my, you know, big desires that we should work together. I was always interested in, you know, some kind of giving back, you know, because as I told you, how we started and where we reached, we got so many opportunities in the era that our country was opening out.
Yeah.
Whenever envisage that this is the kind of resources we will have. So I think it's a duty of everybody. We can't wait for leaders and governments and to change the world. You and I have to change the world.
Yeah. True.
One person at a time. So I was always at a particular point in time, I will retire, take early retirement. I will plow back whatever my experiences and the wealth I have earned into helping society. So this was something that was at the back of my mind. My son also wanted to do something similar. He was more interested in the environment space. I was more interested in the women's space because I've spent so much effort trying to work on that whole diversity agenda in corporate India. For the last 20 years, I've been an ardent proponent of diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, it was women. For him, it was environment. And, you know, this whole climate change, etc. issues were becoming so severe. And that when we sort of put together our circles of interest, we found that there is this is one space because local food does help the environment because you're encouraging farmers to grow what is endemic to the region.
Yes.
They use the same water, the same soil to grow what always was meant to grow in that soil. Mm. Carbon footprint reduces. You're not flying down rice from across the world, but you're eating the rice of your region. Correct? So
yes.
That's how environment and all the self-help groups that we work with are women-led.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how this women and environment and his interest and my interest came together. And really that was the whole genesis of Azul.
Okay. And any reason why you picked Maharashtra?
Maharashtra. So I'm not Maharashtrian. My husband's
yeah.
Maharashtrian. It okay. just so happens that we've stayed here in Bombay for a large part of our corporate life. And I remember, I think it was Mr. A.M. Naik once saying, so there is your Janbhumi and there's your Karmbhumi. And in both these, you have to do something. In your Janbhumi also, you have to do something, and in Karmbhumi. So I think for us, Bombay, Maharashtra has been our Karmbhumi. Most of our working life has been here. So mm-hmm. that's how it started.
And when you talk about these stories of going into these self-help groups that are women-led, it's very surprising since I've also worked with a few of them. I noticed that the women there are far more progressive in their thought processes than the so-called city-bred women. And have you come across any experience like that? And what any story or any woman who has just stayed with you and continues to make you smile?
So you're very right that they are progressive. They want to do a lot more sometimes because they have no choice.
Choice, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The husbands are working in the fields. And so where do you think about a second income? Or where do you think of an alternate source of when your harvest is not, many of the women, their minds are far more ambitious and wanting to figure out solutions. I would say that all the women, if you in the self-help groups that we work with, the genesis of their self-help group has been, for example, there was this couple of ladies who during the pandemic had a great harvest of grapes. They don't know what to do with so much grapes, and then there's no way to sell those grapes also because of the bad. So they converted it to dried raisins, and suddenly they became, big suppliers of raisins. There is another grandmother, Nilima Aji, who works with, who heads one of our SHGs in Alibag, and she sort of worked with her grandson and her daughter-in-law to say that these are the masalas that I've been making across generations. This is the baby porridge I gave you. Can we produce it in bulk and sell it? So many of the recipes are hers,
mm-hmm.
that particular self-help group. Then there are women in our Nandurbar belt, where the children are so, it's such a poor tribal zone and children are very malnourished. So the women there started taking their mahua flour and making laddus out of that because they were high in iron and calcium and giving it to their children to stave off malnutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's a gut that is run by women. The laddus originally were made to give their children, but they are very delicious, very tasty and very healthy. So now we've started sourcing it from them.
Okay. And when you look back on your journey as an entrepreneur, Apurva, I'm sure you have seen a lot of women, and as a consultant, you've seen how brands do their marketing. How much of what you have studied and practiced are you implementing here, or post-pandemic did things, or during the pandemic, did things just change? And the entire algorithm of what you studied to what you actually are implementing shifted? Did it shift at all?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I would say that not what we studied and what we practiced. Of course, a lot of what we've applied subsequently is really out of our practical experience. Right. So you do study the theory of branding, but then in real life, what can you apply? The theory of branding was very clearly demarketed to one television 30-second ad and one full page ad in the print. And suddenly, as I was saying, the Facebook algorithm has got nothing to do with what you studied. But I feel there are certain conclusions or hypotheses that you have taken out from your practical learnings over the last 20 years, which you can apply. So whether it is in brand building, and I was talking to you about the T plan. Mm-hmm. Now, the T plan was developed in maybe the 60s.
Mm.
And after that, there have been so many more theories and so many much more complexity added. But at the base of it, if you answer those five questions, you know that you have a product ready to take to market. If you can't answer any one of those five questions, if you say, okay, there is this passion project that I'm working on, but there's no, why will the consumer buy it? Yeah. And you don't have a strong enough answer for it, it's not going to succeed, how much ever passion you feel. So I think those kind of deductions and hypotheses and conclusions we drew are standing us in good stead, even post-pandemic, because human nature doesn't change, no? The platforms will change and evolve.
Yes.
Humans and what triggers, what emotions will trigger them will remain the same.
That is true. And before the pandemic came your book. You have a wonderful creative mind. I love the simple title, Lady, You're the Boss. From where did that book come? And what prompted you to write it? Did you see, okay, today diversity and inclusion is a big topic and close to Women's Day, all of March, every company has some kind of a program around it. But when you thought of it and had it in your mind, it was not something that people spoke about. And this title itself made women smile, maybe, but I'm sure the rest of them stood up, sat up and was like, okay, what is the message of this book? So how did you even think of this title and what brought you to write the book itself?
So Rashmi, before I wrote Lady, You're the Boss, I wrote another book called Lady, You're Not a Man.
Oh, yes.
Okay, that was my first book.
That
book I wrote way back in 2013. And there I was feeling very frustrated with the fact that as a leader, I was recruiting so many women and most of them were ending up leaving in the first decade of working. And they were leaving because they were all, you know, they couldn't figure out how to balance. They want to work, but they don't know how to manage a small child, the guilt of leaving a little child at home or a husband getting transferred or the parent-in-law saying, why do you need to work, etc., etc. So the first book was essentially written that, you know, here's a practical guide. I'll tell you how you can balance both. I'll tell you how you can be successful at both. I'll tell you how you should not think of it as either or. Either I can be successful at home or at work. I can't merge the two. You can do both. So that was the first book. And I deliberately called it Lady, You're Not a Man, because I don't want you to behave like a man to succeed. You are a woman, you're a mother, you're a wife, but you will still be able to succeed in COVID. You can't give away this role, which they had not seen. They had either seen non-working mothers or aunts who were working but didn't get married. So this juxtaposition they had not yet seen. So, and I also added the adventures of a woman at work, because I don't want you to say, okay, you know, oh my God, I'm suffering so much and, you know, life is so unfair. Working for a working woman, it's an adventure. You should enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So that I did that book 2013. It still continues to be a bestseller after 11 years. Then around just before the pandemic, I suddenly realized that while the first lot of women had sort of written a book which had answers to their dilemmas, at middle management level, a lot of women were again stagnating. So they'd reached general manager. Now in this last decade, many of them are general managers and vice presidents and CXOs. But beyond that, again, there is whether it's a glass ceiling or their own internal barriers, they're not moving up. And they're ending up stagnating. Many of them are leaving at the second stage. This they should not do. No, they've gone through all the hard work of bringing up children and the initial struggle. Why should they leave when you're a general manager? So then I started asking and talking to all these women and figured out they have another set of issues where internal to their heart, they are feeling, oh my God, I've done this fight. I don't want to fight anymore. Or no, you know, the men are also overlooking them because, you know, For a guy, the final position is CEO. For a woman, you became GM. What more do you want? Both internal and external biases were coming in their way. And therefore, the deliberate choice of lady or the boss, because I'm saying, you now, you've fought so hard, don't give up at this stage. There is still another battle. And you are the boss of your career. You are the boss of what you want to do. So take control yet again of your life.
Apurva, you know, if you see, even today, there are very few women who have reached the top levels of leadership. But you stuck on right from a time when women were not seen in that position or in those positions. You stayed on, grew, and became an inspiration. So looking back, what is it that allowed you and made you grow that path very seamlessly and helped you take everything in your stride?
So Rashmi, you know, I often talk to young women, and they, when they see people like me, you know, and you're absolutely right that there is less than 5% women leaders in any sphere of whether it's politics or whether it's Fortune 500 companies, corporate India, education, etc. So they look at me, they say, oh, you must have had some special benefits or some special mentorship or some support, or you must be having some unique talent and skill, and we don't have the same thing. And my answer always is that no, that's not true. I am exactly the same as you. I'm got exactly the same strengths and weaknesses, not extra talent, not extra skill than any of you. But the difference, and two, three things that I feel resulted in me becoming a leader, both at a young age and staying the course, staying through, you know, the 30, 40 years of my career. And one is that I did not give up. So there is a lot of hard work, especially the first 10 years of your married life, children, your career is taking off, your children are growing. So there, you're doing two jobs, maybe even three jobs. So your career is taking off, so you're dedicating a lot of effort there. Your children are growing, so you need to be the primary nurturer. Whatever you say, however fair the world will become, you are the primary nurturer. Okay. And then maybe you will have some other responsibilities, or have ailing parents, etc. And women run away from that hard work. They don't want to do. They give up. And my stance always has been that you can't give up. You can't give up on anything, whether you want to become a successful woman leader or a sales head or a CEO or an entrepreneur. Grit and determination is far more important than any talent, skill, mentorship that you will receive. So you can't give up. And I did not give up. Went through all the same pregnancy, working through the 9 months, traveling by train every day, coming back, cooking, getting ready for the next day. But several of us did that. And that's why we are where we are. I think that's one part. The other is the ability, willingness to take risks. Many women, you know, the stagnation point that we discuss, so, you know, they stagnate at a point because they're comfortable. And we like to be uncomfortable because we've been uncomfortable all our lives. Now people have, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. So when we find a comfort zone, we want to stick there.
Yeah.
But I've always pushed myself out of comfort zones. So whenever I got an opportunity, and other women would have also got the opportunity, but they did not grab it. I grabbed it. It may have been uncomfortable for the first 1 year. I maybe have been a very, let's say, a toxic environment for the first year before I settled in and changed the culture. But I grabbed opportunities. I was willing to walk out of my comfort zone. I think these are the two behaviors. If any woman gets right, she will succeed.
So from this stems a question, Apurva, that today, women have people like you who walk the path as mentors that they can choose to learn from. But you didn't have a lot of mentors to choose from. Life would have been lonely at times because not everybody understands. So you become your best friend, your biggest critic. So what kept you going? Who were the mentors you really sought and learned from? And was a lot of it very, very much from within, that those moments with the self became the biggest learning moments?
I would say, Rashmi, the second one, because as you're rightly saying, there were no mentors, there were no people. Everybody was learning themselves, right? So you didn't even, as we discussed, corporate India didn't have leaders at that time.
Yeah.
But I do say that I did spend a lot of time on reflection. I was always a more self-reflective kind of a person. And from day one, I was one thing I was very clear about is that I don't need to follow a trodden path. I don't need to be popular. I don't need to do what my neighbor is doing, what my colleagues are doing. I will just walk to a tune of my own making. So that, now how that happened, that independence of thinking, see, independence of thought, I can't join any dots and say my parents fostered it or something happened in my life that made me become like that. But I was always very independent minded.
Wow. So I think you're the right person to describe empowerment. A beautiful point to ask you what it means. And since we are in the Women's Month, what does the word empowerment mean to you?
Two things. Empowerment for me means the ability and the resources and the impact-giving skills to empower other women. Otherwise, empowerment generally for me starts with financial independence. I tell the whole world, I tell all the women, whatever you may say, oh, look, I didn't change my surname. That's how empowered I am. Look, I don't cook at home. That's how empowered I am. No. Empowerment, if you are able to earn your own living and not dependent on anybody, you're not your parents, not your brother, not your husband, not your children for your living. That is true empowerment, according to me.
And in a way, Apurva, the pandemic told us that suddenly work from home is a possibility, which was never there. And the workforce that you're talking about, the women who stepped back, had ample opportunity now. And many of the discussions during the pandemic, especially the webinar, spoke about how this is prime time for women to get back. Did it convert like that in your discussions and whatever you saw around you? And what were your reflections from the pandemic? Because here you are telling women, you started off by saying that you're not a man, you have be a woman. And the second one is take charge. And anyway, you fought and came till here, just continue being yourself. And then comes the pandemic saying, okay, for those who step back, it's your time to prove now. So you saw all these three phases. For you, especially personally, what were your reflections? Because the pandemic was a huge teacher for all of us. And in the women that you interacted with, did you see a shift?
So I'll answer the second question first, Rashmi. The fact is that all of us thought of that as an opportunity for women to shine. Okay, now see, okay, so you have a struggle to leave your children at home, go to work. Now you can manage work from home and the world is acknowledging that you can do both. Unfortunately, it did not pan out like that. It did not pan out like that. In fact, our labor force participation after the pandemic for women is lower than what it was before the pandemic.
Oh, really?
Yes. The numbers speak for themselves. And the reason is twofold. One is when people were losing jobs, you know, when they were being asked to go, nobody will say it openly, but the fact was that more of the women were being asked to go and lesser of the men because, again, the subconscious bias. You know, they always say the man's income is the primary income which runs the house.
Yeah.
The woman's income is the add-on. So if the add-on, the HR head is thinking the add-on income goes away, it's okay.
Yeah.
Now, let me not touch the men. So right or wrong, I'm not justifying any decision, but so it was. So women lost, more of the women lost their jobs. Women also ended up being the primary caregiver. So there's an ailing parent got the virus or whatever. So the wife was asked to take care. So again, she stepped back.
Yeah.
The third reason is, and that is so unfortunate because what was an opportunity actually turned out to be a threat only because I've spoken to a lot of HR professionals and women themselves and men, and everybody thinks, not necessarily articulates this, but thinks that, you know, when a man is at home, he's dedicatedly sitting in front of his laptop and working. When a woman is at home, she's only doing 50% office work and 50% she's taking care of the house. So that invisible, again, that, you know, as it is, women don't stand up. And even in office environments, they are the people who will sit in the back row.
Yes.
They won't talk. They won't make themselves heard. And now you're away from the office. So actually, it is not a good thing for women to be away from office, because already you're less visible. Now you've become invisible.
Okay.
So you're not going to get the best jobs and the chances to do great projects and all if you're sitting at home. You're thinking, I'm balancing both, but you're not getting. You're not getting due visibility and thus the due promotions, projects, growth.
Recognition. Okay. And because a lot of articles spoke about how women came back, maybe percentage wise, not what was expected, but there was a shift. I for me, this is a surprise that it actually didn't pan out the way it was meant to.
Didn't.
Okay, that's sad. And for you personally, Apurva, the pandemic, what did it shift in you?
One, the biggest shift, of course, was that during the pandemic is, you know, I'd been threatening to quit for a long time. enough, I have to get to what I really wanted to do, which is social impact. But pandemic really said that you better do it now. No, what are you waiting for?
Yeah.
As it is, the inequality divide is going up. You have been talking about it. So now time for action has come now. So that really sort of gave me that push, that do it. This is the time to help. And indeed, that became the biggest reason for me to leave and set up Azol. The other reflections I would say is that, you know, I personally enjoyed the quietness around, the settling of noise that happened, because, you know, especially as women, you're constantly running, you know, you're multitasking and you're going to work and coming back and taking care of things at home and then getting up ready in the morning and going back again to work. So you have had no me time at all. Suddenly, when the noise, and there are so many expectations, your parents' expectation, your office's expectation, your junior's expectation, your family's expectation. So you, what about your expectations of yourself? Now, suddenly when that has quietened down, you get time to listen to yourself.
Yeah.
And I thought that for me gave me the calmness of space to sort of ask, what do I want? And then you realize that, my God, why? I don't need to multitask. I mean, yes, I needed to do it when my son was young, when he was, you know, when I was in my 20s or 30s. In my 50s, why am I still on the same treadmill doing 55 things when it's not required?
Yeah.
So that's just one example, but it gave me time to sort of, it gave me space and quietness to really say, what do I want? And get rid of all the external, both expectations and your desire to be, you know, some that status that all of us sort of keep chasing.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You know, when you're saying this, I can only visualize somebody who was there everywhere,
yes,
suddenly finding comfort in silence. You spoke about the noise that the branding world has created, and suddenly it became the power of silence, because it was a forced silence, not that we wished for it, because there are very few people who are comfortable with silence. And this silence that was forced on you made a lot of us reflect, because we suddenly wondered and realized we are finite. And I think that was the biggest realization that kind of shook a lot of people, a lot of people. And that's where the game started changing, the thought process started changing. But sadly, I think we're getting back to what it was, rather than learn the lessons and move a little more with caution and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and talking about meaning, the last part of this conversation, three life lessons that you'd like to leave us with.
One, interesting the word I read. If you choose the hard path, life becomes easier. If you choose the easier path, life becomes harder. So I think I really resonated with that one. And that's the thing I keep on telling young girls also, that, you know, first 10, 15 years are hard work to manage home, work, but do it. Life will become easier. You run away and then later is going to become tougher. That's one thing. The second thing is, I feel that all of us at every, as you talked about, you know, we realize we are finite. So I think all of us have to keep on every day wanting to become the best versions of ourselves. And it's a daily effort. Okay. And you have to keep evolving. If you don't evolve, stagnation is the only other option. So it personally, professionally, as a human being, as whatever, I think evolution and moving aage is mandatory for everybody. That is my second lesson. Third is what Annie Dillard said, which is, finally, how you live your days is how you live your life. So let us not all wait for that marquee moment when we'll be happy. Let us not wait for that big thing that will come our way, which will give us joy, success, however we define it. I think success, happiness, joy, contentment is equally found in the little things we do every day. And before you realize, that's how you've lived your life. So what are the small joys, small contentments, small wins that you have every day? I would think of it, life lessons like that.
This is so beautiful, because this is how we started the conversation, of how with your mother seeding that dream of IIM, a career for you was set. And that's what you thought defines empowerment as well. So without actually defining empowerment, she fed you and walked the talk on what is empowerment. Love the fact that you've led every word that you have just spoken and walked your talk through and through, Apoorva. An honor having you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty. I am super, super excited that we could finally manage this conversation, and may your tribe increase, because I think people like you make us look at us as women far more proudly and with a smile that says, you are enough. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ashmi, for inviting me. And I hope I answered the questions to your satisfaction. And I'm sure.
Of course you did. Thank you so much, Apoorva.
With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.